how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Green Line, an environmental justice dinner series on Thursday, April 18th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Abundant Life Church in Portland. Green Line features Amira Streeter, natural resources policy advisor to Governor Brown, and Edward Hill, urban planner and community systems designer. These leaders will discuss pressing environmental issues impacting communities of color and vulnerable communities in Portland and in Greater Oregon. Again, that's Green Line, an environmental justice dinner series on Thursday, April 18th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Abundant Life Church, 3935 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, KBOO's News and Public Affairs Day during our spring membership drive. Coming up next at 2 o'clock is Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Differences Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, with Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. At 3, it's Special News and Public Affairs Day airing of Alternative Radio, featuring a talk by Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. At 4, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And at 5, it's your KBOO Evening News. KBOO is in the midst of its spring membership drive, and we urge you to take a moment to give a call to 877-500-5266 and show your commitment to your community radio station.
On April 4th, 2019, Dr. Vysotsky, an assistant professor of sociology and criminology at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, spoke at Cider Riot in Portland. The speech was called Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, the difference between fascist and Antifa movements in the Trump era. We begin with one of the hosts giving an introduction. We did not catch their name.
Our guest speaker today is Dr. Vysotsky. He's a professor and expert on social movement activism. He's here to speak to us about militant anti-fascism, how these movements develop, and how they organize against white supremacists and white nationalist movements emboldened by the current administration. And without further ado, please give a warm welcome to Dr. Vysotsky.
Thank you. So this talk is it's the second of three talks, and it's going to be focused primarily on looking at the tactics of fascist and anti-fascist groups in contrast. And the reason I'm looking at it this way is because personally, as a sociologist, it's my framework, but also a lot of the way in which people create the both sides narrative comes from a discourse about fascism and anti-fascism that doesn't actually focus on any kind of social movement analysis or what fascists or anti-fascists do. What it does is it often focuses either on the actual ideology, so we have this kind of abstract marketplace of ideas approach of thinking about fascism and anti-fascism, that the greatest ideas will somehow win out, or it psychologizes in particular fascism. So there's a lot of analysis of the individual psychology of fascists and what motivates them, how they operate, things of that nature, which individualizes their activity, and therefore anti-fascism is supposed to respond to that individual psychology as opposed to what fascists do collectively as a movement. So as a sociologist, what I'm interested in is what people do collectively and how people operate collectively. And as someone who studies social movements, I'm interested in how those collective operations then impact both large-scale social processes and also policy level and generally other movement dynamics. I want to start by talking specifically about fascism and fascist movements. Fascist tactics have two general kinds of frameworks in terms of their specificity. The first of which is a leaderless resistance model, so that when we think about fascist movements, we're not looking at a large-scale hierarchical organization. We're not talking about the kind of classical fascist models where there is a single leader who is leading some sort of broad organization. What we're dealing with here is a broad network of individuals, of small organizations, of small-scale cells. This in particular is a map of Daily Stormer users from about 2017. And this demonstrates a distinct tactic for the movement, that is that they approach their activity as something that is coordinated but only loosely around one central ideology. And even in terms of that central ideology, there are internal divisions in terms of what certain factions believe and different sectors of the movement and how they operate. So not every single actor, not every single organization is going to engage in the same kinds of tactics. The other thing to understand in terms of what fascists do is that fascists engage in violence, and that fascism is built around what I like to refer to as an imperative toward violence. That is, that fascist ideology is built towards violence, not just as a means to achieve some sort of future society, but also as the goal in and of itself. That a fascist society is a society built around the use of violence, because fascists view violence as something that makes an individual spiritually better. And so a fascist society is one where violence becomes routinized, becomes normalized, becomes built into the operation of the order, the hierarchy, the genocidal practices of the world that they want. So these are crucial things to understand about fascism. So now, having set that up, I want to talk specifically about the tactics of fascist movements. So fascist movements, first and foremost, engage in propaganda campaigns. They engage in a lot of the kind of legitimate political activity, the stuff of normative politics, such as flyering campaigns, producing literature, getting their ideas out into the world. Those campaigns are designed specifically to try to get sympathetic individuals to contact organizations, to make connections, to become part of larger groups. They are part and parcel of any political organization. They also engage in protest events and rallies. These rallies and protest events are generally built around some sort of focal incident, so that they are often based on an event, a trigger event of some sort, that allows a fascist group to come into a community to stage a demonstration ostensibly for some purpose, whether it is a tension in terms of changing norms around race, around gender, around sexual orientation, around gender identity, whether it is around issues of bias crime, things of that nature are sort of trigger events that will create rallies. And the rallies are simultaneously, again, an attempt to build the movement, attempt to bring in new members, but also a way for existing members to come together and build solidarity, build ties, build links with one another, and an end in and of themselves. Because the fascist movement, for them, the rallies are a way of moving out from the underground, of making themselves public, of putting themselves out into the world and saying basically that they are actors, they are political actors, they have a position that people should recognize as on some level legitimate. So that's the purpose of rallies. And then related to this is engagement in public discourse and debate. So fascists look to the public, they look to public discourse, they look to be recognized in the media, they use these platforms as an opportunity to spread their ideas, as an opportunity again to bring in sympathetic individuals. Having a media platform allows fascists to put out their message so that individuals can then become involved in this broadly loose coalition through a variety of different inputs, some of which I'm going to talk about as part of this talk. But the other point is to have the debate itself. Because by having the debate itself, it places fascism as a legitimate concept, a legitimate topic worthy of discourse and discussion. Because fascism, rather than being something that has been largely discredited as legitimate, largely discredited in terms of its framework and in terms of the central arguments that it uses for its own justifications, by having a debate, it means that it becomes something worthy of debate and discussion, not something that has been generally pointed to as false. And the way that I think about it is, when we think about, say, the controversy over having speakers on campuses and the supposed free speech issue, no university, like geography or geology department, would ever have a flat earther come. Right? No physics department would have somebody come who has a heliocentric view of the universe. So why is it that campuses should create a space for fascist discourse for people whose research has been ultimately discredited by academic discourse? Right? And that's the point. That's the point for the fascists, is that they want that legitimacy. They want that credit. They want it to be something that can be placed on par with the actual canon, whether it's the physical sciences or the social sciences. So moving on, beyond the kind of traditional political activity is online activity. The fascist movement has developed, has grown, has mushroomed over the last 15, 20 years, in large part due to its ability to leverage online activity and leverage an online presence in order to be able to give itself a platform. So the first way in which it has done this is through internal discussion. That is that the fascist movement has created a space for itself to be able to engage in discourse among itself. Some of the earliest websites, in fact, we know that the world record holder for the longest running website on the internet is Stormfront. So the fascists win, basically, in terms of having a space and having a presence in that regard. And that Stormfront, being probably the most public version of this, is an intentional space. It has always been an intentional space for the movement to speak to itself, for this decentralized network of individuals to be able to communicate with one another, to be able to be part of a movement, part of something bigger than simply themselves, to be able to plan outside of the space of something like Stormfront. And so all of these sites, whether they're Stormfront or whether they're the Daily Storm or whether they are individual Discord chats, where they're moving increasingly into self-referential discourse, where it's not, there's one level where it's public discourse and then there's another level where it's the movement talking to itself, where it's the people who are now part of the more activist wing as opposed to the online troll wing of things, who are making plans, who are using the technology that is afforded through social media, through internet communication, to be able to build a movement and to be able to plan for the activity of the movement, whether it is something as simple as the firing campaigns to the actual acts of violence, which I will get to soon enough.
You are listening to a speech called Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era by Dr. Vysotsky here on News and Public Affairs Day at KBOO Community Radio.
And welcome to our spring pledge drive. Hi there, I am Michelle Coppola, and I am pitching today with...
with Conch. It's good. It's great to be here, and it's great to be here on the day that so many of us who... oh, are passionate about public news and public affairs. This is our day to just sit back and take it all in, take all these amazing new speeches, these guests, all of these panels and shows that come our way. This is a great time for you to show your appreciation for News and Public Affairs Day. And Michelle, what's the best way for people to do that?
They can do that online at kboo.fm. They can call us. We'd love to talk to you. We have some wonderful folks on the phones back here who are just enjoying some Atlas pizza. Yeah, 877-500-5266. They'd love to talk to you. And listen, it's really important for you to make that gift right now. And here's why. We have a $1,500 matching grant going on right now. So your donation is going to be maximized. Your gift is going to be maximized to KBOO. So now is the time to give. Today is the time to give. $10 a month, $120 a year. We can break it up for you as low as $5 a month. But anything you give today is going to be matched by that $1,500 grant. And by the way, we have a great thank you gift as well, that Stylin Press Watch t-shirt that is up there for Teresa's program. She's been doing here 25 years, I think. Just wonderful. One of the most popular programs on KBOO. And it's a great looking t-shirt,
fabulous
too.
Graphic by Amy Sitars, yes.
Yay! That is just beautiful. If you'd like to get your hands on that, 877-500-5266 or go to kboo.fm and make your gift. Now is the time to give. With this matching grant, you can really maximize what you can do for KBOO. Because let me tell you know, I'm a fairly new volunteer here, and I am doing news. I'm working in the news department. I do news on Mondays and Fridays with Ken and with Linda, and I got to tell you, the news and the voices and the perspectives you hear on KBOO, you're not going to hear anywhere else.
Yeah, the news here at KBOO, this is not like anything anywhere else in the dial. These are your friends and neighbors who are going out there and pulling in the stories, putting them together, and they're learning everything for free here at KBOO, because that is what your donation pays for when you call in. And it's maximum, it's double your pledge time right now. So when you call in and do it in the next, you know, take a break. If you're at work, if you're running errands, do it now. Go to kboo.fm or toll free 877-500-KBOO, 877-500-5266. Get your membership doubled.
We return to Challenging the Both Sides Narrative by Dr. Vysotsky, here on News and Public Affairs Day at KBOO Radio.
So in terms of these internal sites, they also have, of course, internal media. So they have media where they're talking to themselves, Gab being the best example, but to some extent they are also, if you look at their social media, to some extent they're talking to themselves. I mean, if you look at fascist Twitter accounts, nobody else really is getting their references. You know, they're designed for an external audience, but the language is an internal audience language. So to some extent, these spaces are being used for an internal discussion that gives the movement cohesion, because movements operate not just in terms of these kinds of practical, pragmatic things like going out and flyering and having meetings and rallies and things like that, but they also have a vast sort of culture built around them. And so in terms of the tactical approach, social media is crucial, because once you've established that you have an internal space, once you've established an internal language, then it's important to be able to move out and branch out and speak to a larger, wider audience. And that wider audience is basically built in with social media, with the kinds of free speech, open platform approaches that a number of sites have taken to creating a space for fascist discourse. They've also created the ability for fascists to figure out how to use the structure of these sites in order to promote themselves. So that we know, because of empirical research on YouTube, that the YouTube algorithm is set up in such a way that certain kinds of keywords being used by fascists put their videos into top suggestions and recommendations. You know, so you can go very easily from how to fix your sink to how the Jews have ruined your sink. Takes like three steps. It's probably a real video out there. But you get the idea. I mean, this is part of an actual set process, and it's part of something that people have developed and worked out internally. So basically, the social media approach is one that is designed to build a mass audience, to get people to, again, have a platform, but it's also a space for fascist activism in terms of the virtual version of the kind of violence that I began, sort of preceded this with. That a lot of the activity that is occurring is also designed to be the violence of internet usage through trolling, through targeted harassment of individuals, through approaches that create an unsafe space online. Fascists are able to use social media as a space that the sociologist Pete Simi refers to as a prefigurative space. And prefigurative spaces are movement spaces where you create the society you want to see in the future. So fascists are using this variety of online platforms in order to try to create this kind of fascist prefigurative space. And then, of course, the last thing, the ultimate fascist tactic, is violence itself. And fascists use violence. Fascists engage in violence. So they engage in violence in terms of committing bias crimes. And for anyone who studies bias crimes, what we know as scholars is that there is no good data on bias crimes. There is no way to get a sense of the scale and the scope of bias crimes. The FBI collects statistics, but they collect voluntary statistics from police departments, which is why states like Mississippi and Alabama report bias crimes that are 0, that are 8, things like that. So we know that the federal numbers are somewhat useless. We know through a Bureau of Justice Statistics report that analyzed the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is a survey of people who have been victimized or know someone who's been a victim of a crime, that through an estimate of that data, there might be as many as 250,000 bias crimes in a given year. And we have very little data on the perpetrators of those bias crimes because most of them are going unreported. But we do know that fascists commit bias crimes because we have story after story over and over and over again that fascists are engaging in these kinds of low-level crimes. They are part of the process of going from a prospect to a full member if you're going to be involved in a fascist organization. They are part of the process of just having fun sometimes for groups of fascists. The typical model that sociologists point out is a thrill kind of bias crime. But they're also ideologically impaired. They are the things that fascists are going to do. They're going to commit violence on some level or another. And that violence is going to take the form of everything ranging from bias crimes to mass shooting terror events to protest violence. And all of these things are part of the process of activity for fascists because the ideology says to them that the world they want to achieve must be achieved through violence. And that the world they are going to achieve requires violence because they have an eliminationist ideology. The eliminationist ideology says that all of the groups that they oppose, and I cannot name them all because they will find groups, I mean, based on, I will just say, based on race, based on gender identity, based on sexual orientation, based on religion or ethno-religious identity, based on national identity. And I can keep going. All of these groups are subject to violence because the best they can do, the least violent thing that they can say is that what they want is a separate ethno-state where they will forcibly deport people. And that's violence. So violence is the means to the end. But violence also is focused on their political opposition, especially in this stage. In this stage, fascists, particularly in the United States, are, let's face it, numerically they're marginalized, but they represent a fairly large proportion of the population. In fact, people don't like to talk about the ABC News poll that came out shortly after Charlottesville that found that 9% of Americans would identify as alt-right. 22 million people identified themselves as fascists, basically. So they may be 9%, but 22 million is a lot. So they may be small, they may be marginalized, their ideas have greater and greater currency in mainstream political discourse. But right now they also have opposition. And so street violence, protest violence is crucial for them because it is their attempt to establish dominance in order to start moving into that kind of policy sphere of violence. So that's fascist violence. That's essentially the broad sweep of fascist tactics. I apologize that I did not get into minutiae and some of the other things that fascists do. There's a lot here, but I figured for time, just give you kind of a broad sweep. So I want to move on to anti-fascist tactics. Anti-fascist tactics are motivated by one very simple goal. stop fascism. Anti-fascist tactics are from a sociological perspective, anti-fascist tactics are counter-movement tactics. They are tactics that are developed in order to limit the activity of a particular social movement. And in this case, it is a social movement that is unique. What makes fascism and anti-fascism unique and different from most other opposing movements, and there's a whole literature in sociology and social movement studies on opposing movements, because there are movements that oppose each other on almost any issue of import. And almost all of those movements are focused on some sort of policy geared towards the state. And that's where anti-fascism and fascism are different, in that fascism is not geared towards some set of policies. Fascism is geared towards what we refer to as state displacement. Even if they want to capture the state, what they want to do is displace the current state and replace it with a fascist state. And so anti-fascists are not opposing a movement in order to put some sort of policy in place. What they are doing is working to demobilize fascists, keep them from actually operating as a movement. Because what they have recognized is that there's more at stake than simply a set of policy decisions or a set of abstract principles or theoretical ideas. As I point out in other research, anti-fascists often have an awareness of the threat that fascism poses that is much greater than individuals who don't take an anti-fascist stance. So, anti-fascist tactics. There are two things to think about in terms of anti-fascism. Anti-fascism, because it is a broad position in opposition to fascism and has one goal, to stop fascism, it actually sociologically takes two forms. One of them is what I call informal anti-fascism. And informal anti-fascism is the kind of stuff that happens spontaneously, the kind of work that occurs when people simply take it upon themselves to engage in some sort of anti-fascist activity because there's a necessity to it, whether it's a group of punks or people who are in black metal or whatever at a show kicking Nazis out spontaneously, or whether it's people identifying a Nazi and bringing some consequences to their open displays of Nazism. These are all acts of informal anti-fascism because they're done by people who may not necessarily be affiliated with any sort of organization, may not have taken any sort of political stance as anti-fascist, but they're still engaging in anti-fascism. The other form is what I refer to as formal anti-fascism. And formal anti-fascism is the work of people who are organized specifically for the purpose of confronting and combating fascist mobilization and movements. This is the work that falls under the banner of Antifa more broadly. And even formal anti-fascism has certain distinctions and divisions within it. There is what I refer to as non-militant anti-fascism. So activities in terms of non-militant anti-fascism are things that would be considered normative in terms of political practices. It's a lot of work that would be acceptable to people because it's the kind of work that it falls under the ideas of normal movement activity or even normal counter-movement activity. It's the stuff that opposing movements do regardless of their orientation, you know, even the ones that are sort of policy-oriented. So that's the kind of non-militant. And then there's the militant. And what makes militant anti-fascism different from non-militant is not so much the distinction that you'll see in mass media, that militant anti-fascists are some sect of violent-prone people who are out there to smash heads and things of that nature. But militant anti-fascists do the kinds of things that non-militant anti-fascists do with a particularly aggressive style and with a style that often is more confrontational than a typical kind of non-militant would engage in.
That was Dr. Vysotsky.
And you are listening to KBOO's News and Public Affairs Day. The program is challenging the both sides narrative. That is Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. And I am Michelle Coppola, along with...
I'm here with Michelle. I'm Conch. And we are delighted to be bringing you all of this very, very immediate and very relevant content today on News and Public Affairs Day. This is our spring membership drive, and we are just taking a few minutes every now and then to make sure that you have a good opportunity to go online at kboo.fm. That's where you can see you hit the donate button, and you get all sorts of cool little options. You get pictures of thank you gifts that you can get if you like that sort of thing. You got ways that you can donate. You can use a credit card. You can use a monthly deduction from checking. You can just, you can come into 20 Southeast 8th with a bag of cash if you like.
And oh, and by the way, there are some really delectable dark chocolate peanut butter cups up front. If there's still some left,
oh my,
grab one and then make your gift, all right?
we're just half a block south of Burnside on the east side of the bridge. And absolutely, drop in. We do have people dropping in, 20 Southeast 8th. Sometimes they like to look at the t-shirts or maybe the CDs or tickets that are available. They're all here. And you can also, if you don't want to, you know, take that time out of your day, you just want to take 3 minutes, 4 minutes out of your day, talk to one of our fabulous phone volunteers. And that option is toll-free, 877-500-KBOO. It's 877-500-5266.
You know, if you don't mind, one of the things they told me when they asked me to pitch is just go in, be yourself, tell your story. So I thought that what I might do is tell my story a little bit here, because I'm a fairly new volunteer here at KBOO doing news and interviews and things like that. And I have actually a lot of radio experience. I worked in the radio business for about 25 years, and I'm not in it anymore for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons that I'm not in it anymore is I was tired of the homogenized, corporatized style of commercial radio, and I wanted to hear something different. I wanted to be part of something. I wanted to use my broadcasting skills to really make a difference. And that's why I'm here at KBOO now. And you can make a difference with your gift, even if you can't give that much. I mean, most of the people who give to KBOO, most of the members, you know, they give monthly gifts of small amounts. You can go as low as $5 a month. That's a total of $60 a year. Break it up to $10 a month for $120 a year. And we will turn you on to one of those great Press Watch t-shirts if you do that. And here's the best part about giving. If you do it, you know, this day on this public affairs and news day, you will be part of maximizing your gift with the matching gift that we have of $1,500. We have that match going on right now, but you got to give today for News and Public Affairs Day to make that count. So come on, pick up the phone or go to kboo.fm, 877-500-5266. Walk in the door, however is most convenient and comfortable for you. We have volunteers in-house who can even give you a tour if you wanted to actually drop by the studios. We would love to meet you. Again, that's kboo.fm, 877-500-5266. I sure would like those phones to ring, because this is an important place to be.
Yes, absolutely. This is it. That is the easiest way to call in. And why not do it now? I mean, because, I mean, really, right this minute, when there's a match, when you can get twice your membership that is ending up in KBOO's coffers for paying the bills and training volunteers and making sure that the equipment works, 877-500-KBOO. Yeah, this is the time. This is the time to match. This is the time to make everything work really well. Just Yep. Put down what you're doing. Put down the gardening tools and call 877-500-5266. Yeah, I'm an old radio hand too, like Michelle. And you know, when I was growing up as a kid, this is how long ago I was growing up, you could rely on commercial radio to have a lot of local content. If a band was coming through town, they might stop into the studio. If an author was coming to town, they would do that as well and have a conversation. Yet nowadays, it's all this content that's trucked in from somewhere out of town, from somewhere in Texas or Florida. So, you know, in some ways, I've benefited here by being a KBOO public affairs person, because I get all these amazing people that can't get arrested anywhere else at a commercial station. Penelope Spheris, Marjan Satrapi, Bill Curtis, wow. Crispin Glover have all come into the studio and talked with me. And it's great. This is the content you get when you contribute to your community radio station, which really does do local news, international news, public affairs that's relevant for you. So give it go online right now, kboo.fm, or talk to one of our fabulous volunteers. They are so ready to tell you all the great options that'll work for you. And that number again, toll-free, 877-500-KBOO. That's 877-500-5266. 5266.
We return to a speech by Dr. Vysotsky.
For non-militants, there are a lot of non-militants who do intelligence gathering. Intelligence gathering is a core component of anti-fascist activity. It's a core component of anti-fascist tactics. There are lots and lots of organizations who do non-militant anti-fascist intelligence work. The Anti-Defamation League does it. The Southern Poverty Law Center does it. And they have a lot of information. And they do it in a way that generally is presented with, here is this group, we have learned some stuff about them, we're going to let you know about it. Militant anti-fascists do the same kind of intelligence work. Often militant anti-fascists do it in a way that doesn't bar them in the ways that non-militants do. And so they're able to get information that certain non-militants don't have access to. But militant anti-fascists also do it with a call to action. So that when militant anti-fascists are gathering intelligence, they're gathering intelligence for the purposes of being able to action it towards some sort of demobilization effort. And that intelligence gathering is put to use in terms of education campaigns. So that anti-fascists, again, regardless of their orientation, are engaging in campaigns to educate the general public on the fascist movement. What are the beliefs and the core ideologies of the fascist movement? And there are certainly a number of people resident to this town who have published books on that topic, who have done talks on that topic, who have worked towards that educational campaign. Educational campaigns that are built around understanding how to recognize a fascist, because the fascist movement increasingly marks itself in esoteric ways, in ways that the individual outside of its own milieu will not be able to understand, that internal language. So these are all designed to give people a sense to kind of inoculate people against fascism, because knowing may be enough to produce the kind of spontaneous informal anti-fascism I talked about, or get people mobilized into the kind of formal anti-fascist work that I'm talking about now. So it's an inoculation, but it's also a call to action. So that, in particular, for militant anti-fascists, when they're putting out information, they're putting out information that's designed specifically to get people to mobilize and to do something with that information. It's not simply enough to recognize hate symbols. You have to take some sort of action from the militant perspective. Anti-fascism, in particular militant anti-fascism, is a lot of cultural work. It is cultural work in part because the fascist movement engages in cultural work, and so anti-fascists have to counter the cultural work of fascists. But also, the cultural work is itself important to the movement. The cultural work of anti-fascism creates a common identity, it creates bonds, it gives people an ability to organize into moving from the kind of informal anti-fascism of music scene opposition to the kind of formal anti-fascism of organizations and organizing in order to stop movements before they become a viable threat. Anti-fascist culture also works to mark public space so that when people are anti-fascist in public, it sends a message to fascists. It tells them that certain spaces are spaces that are marked as not hospitable to them, as spaces where there will be resistance, as spaces where people will demonstrate opposition. And it marks the spaces so that they're safe spaces for people. So that if a person is in a space, they know that this is a space that is not welcoming to fascists. That is not a place where, because that's part of the point, part of the tactic of fascist activity is to make sure that the populations that they are marking for elimination feel threatened, feel like spaces are uncomfortable, feel like they can't go out into public spaces, out into the streets, things of that nature. So by marking public space, anti-fascists are creating a climate where they can demonstrate that there is opposition, that communities that are being threatened, there is somebody out there who is working on opposition. Anti-fascists also engage in campaigns of what are referred to as public shaming, or what everyone else calls doxing. And that's the point. When we think about what anti-fascists are doing when they are doxing, they are putting out information about individuals in order to create a sense of shame in terms of who they are, in order to maximize any sort of stigma, and there is a certain amount of stigma we can recognize because it works. Fascists get fired from their jobs. Fascists lose their places where they live. Fascists get kicked out of schools that they attend. So there is a stigma associated at this point with being a fascist. And so anti-fascists are leveraging that stigma, engaging in campaigns to shame people who are fascists. And the reason that they're doing this is because when they engage in these kinds of activities, it increases the cost of participation. That's the technical term that we use. That what it does is it means that individuals have to make calculated choices about their fascist activism. Is their activism more important than their job, than where they live, than their education, things of that nature? Are they willing to take those risks? And sometimes they are. And sometimes they're willing to do that. Sometimes they're proud to take on the public shame. But a lot of times they're not. A lot of times the stigma is more than they can handle. And so these campaigns of doxing are not just campaigns designed to do what fascist doxing campaigns do, which is basically threaten people. And that's what fascists do when they dox people. They're basically putting out a threat. They're like, we know where you live and we're coming for you. Anti-fascists are putting out doxing information and saying, there's a fascist living here. You should be aware of this person. You should be wary of this person. This person may be a danger to you. So this is how public shaming works. And then there's confrontation. Anti-fascists engage in activities that are designed to disrupt fascist activity. And they're designed to disrupt fascist activity because, as I've already noted, when fascists mobilize, when fascists are given a platform, they are able to build their movement. They are able to, at the very least, even if they get no converts, even if nobody hears their message and nobody says, you know what, I really do think that there's some sort of Jewish conspiracy that is ruining my life. You know, even if that's not going to happen, if fascists are able to mobilize, if fascists are able to hold an event, it means that they can internally, at least amongst themselves, say that they have been successful. So when anti-fascists disrupt events, they are disrupting at least, at minimum, that ability to claim internal success. So anti-fascists will engage in a number of tactics that are an escalation of disruption. They'll do things like phone jams. So if they learn of an event, they will try to encourage people to contact a venue, contact a promoter, contact a hotel where fascists are staying, do something in order to, again, leverage that public shaming aspect of things in order to disrupt an event. And sometimes that's enough. Sometimes it's enough to simply make sure that they don't have a venue. Anti-fascists will, if that fails, engage in preemptive occupation of spaces. So when fascists are planning a rally, anti-fascists will show up an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, middle of the night if need be, in order to make sure that they don't get that space. Because if they don't get that space, if they can't have their event, then they can't claim a success there. And then, of course, there's the direct counter-protest. You know, if you can't shut it down beforehand in one way or another, anti-fascists will make sure that their presence is known, that fascists know that there is opposition to them. Because fascists, when they see the non-militant tactic of a counter-rally that happens away from the site of a fascist event that is designed to demonstrate community unity, they laugh at that. Because they know it's not disrupting their activity. Because they know it's not keeping them from mobilizing. Because while it is mobilizing a segment of a community, it's not mobilizing them in opposition to the fascists. It's mobilizing them in another space. And so disruption of activity is crucial. Being at the event, even if you can't stop it, to demonstrate that there is opposition is crucial because it demonstrates that there are people who are willing to take steps to stop it. And last but not least, there's the actual confrontation aspect. The tiny little sliver, that 5 to 10% of what militant anti-fascists do that makes all the headlines. Because ultimately, if we're talking about the cost of participation, then the cost of participation for anti-fascists, or raising the cost of participation for fascists by militant anti-fascists, is done by any means necessary. Because, as I've already noted, they understand that there is a distinct threat being posed. And because they understand that there's a distinct threat being posed, they will act in order to make sure that fascists don't mobilize. And if that means confrontation that involves conflict between opposing groups, then conflict between opposing groups happens. And it's not, if we think about it in terms of mobilization, it's not because anti-fascists are looking for violence. It's not because anti-fascists are oriented towards violence. It's because the fascists are moving into spaces with a violent intent. It's that fascists, when they are able to hold rallies, will use those rallies as springboards for more successful rallies. And when fascists are demobilized, their movements start to go further underground, people start to leave, people start to not participate. And so what we know is that confrontation works. Richard Spencer doesn't give as many speeches as he used to. And he openly said, it's because it's no fun anymore because people keep showing up and raising the cost of participation. And I mean literally raising the cost of participation because he has to pay for security. So Antifa, anti-fascism, militant anti-fascism, the tactics are fundamentally different from the tactics of fascists because they are seeking two very different goals. Fascist tactics are in service of an ideology of violence. Whatever they're doing, whether it's something that fits under the rubric of constitutionally protected free speech or is actual acts of violence in service of an ultimate eliminationist end, it is violence in one form or another. Anti-fascist tactics, on the other hand, are counter-movement moves. They are moves designed to, if possible, preempt those activities by fascists, or if necessary, to stop them. Thank you.
You're listening to Dr. Vysotsky, who spoke at Cider Riot April 4th, 2019.
Thank you. Thank you. Ray, this is fascinating. I'm Conch. I'm here with Michelle.
Hey, glad to be with you pitching today on our membership drive. It is springtime. It's time to make a new start. And if you've been a listener of KBOO, if you enjoy the programming you hear, especially on news and public affairs, those kind of programs like the one you're hearing right now, where they're really doing a deep dive into fascism and the Antifa movements, then you need to join us. We'd love to have you. This kind of programming doesn't happen without you. And we want to, in that vein, say a real big thank you to Ethan from Astoria, a brand new member. Let's give it up for Ethan. Oh, we have a cowbell, more cowbell. Yes, we need more cowbell. Don't we need more cowbell?
Everybody needs more cowbell.
Absolutely. And he got himself a copy of Zucked, the book. That was actually, that's an amazing book.
We heard Ken Jones interviewing the author, doing a fabulous interview. That was so fascinating.
It really was. Just incredible. It's amazing how, and kind of scary how we're being manipulated, isn't it? I
mean, yeah. It is. But, you know, this is your antidote for being manipulated. And you get to call the shots when you become a member of KBOO at any amount that you want, any way that you want to contribute. The easiest way is a few dollars a month, the way that I do it, the way that so many people here do it. And the easy ways to do it, one of them is to go online at KBOO.fm, hit the donate button. You can see all sorts of options there. You can see pictures of thank you gifts. Or to call toll-free, talk to one of our volunteers, 877-500-KBOO. That's 877-500-5266. And even some folks like to stop in at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, have a slice of pizza, cup of coffee, get a tour of the station or whatever. You know, Michelle, this News and Public Affairs Day is really one of my favorites every time that Membership Drive comes around. I think it's such a fabulous opportunity. I'm learning so much. I mean, there's so much that you can learn about what's going on in your own town. We have people, white nationalists, coming down, and you see Antifa in the streets, opposing them. And you're getting a real interesting rundown of the tactics here. And you know, there are people here. You hear discussions around KBOO all the time if you hang out here with other folks here. Not everybody loves the Black Bloc. There's a lot of controversy around the Black Bloc. But you know, the Black Bloc wouldn't be around if it weren't for the people who are coming here from out of town and promoting violence against people of color and people who are of, you know, who don't fit into their little box. So this is a fascinating discussion. This is a fascinating news and public affairs special that we're hearing. And there's so much here that happens every day on KBOO that just really is relevant, that I was listening to shows today that were teaching me all sorts of things. You know, $5 a month, that's a fraction of what normally people pay for cable, a small fraction, and that keeps this stuff fresh and going when you go online.
That doesn't even pay for the taxes on cable. Okay, no, it's true. Let's be honest, you're truly. You know, and one of the things you have to remember is that not every community has what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bright, shining light, a voice crying in the wilderness. That's what KBOO is, really. I mean, you're going to hear organic, authentic, local voices here.
Chicago doesn't even have a community radio station.
Right.
But Portland does. That's why it's such a vital arts and literary scene, really, is because KBOO has been here for 50 years.
And, you know, this kind of programming doesn't happen just by chance. It only happens with your help. We definitely need you to pick up the phone, 1-877-500-5266 or KBOO, 500-KBOO, or KBOO.FM. I didn't realize that's what that was until you started saying 5266. Oh, that's KBOO. There you go. 877. Yeah. 500-5266 or KBOO or KBOO.FM. And important to remember, very important to remember, is we have a matching grant on this News and Public Affairs Day of $1,500.
Right.
Yeah.
You're double your money.
Maximize your gift. Yeah. You're going to be giving more without any extra effort from yourself. So there you go.
KBOO.FM or toll free 877-500-KBOO. There's some cool stuff that people can get too when they donate at certain amounts.
Yeah, actually, if you donate at the $10 a month amount, I mean, 10 bucks a month, $120 a year, we break it up into 12 easy payments for you, you will get this awesome, absolutely awesome Press Watch t-shirt. The graphic on it, the artist's name is, tell me again,
Amy Sitars.
Yeah, it is really something you'll be very proud to wear. They come in black, and we have several left of them. They go up to sizes 2XL. And if you give at the $10 a month level, 120 bucks a year, then we will turn you on to one of those fabulous looking t-shirts that you will be very proud to wear in Portland.
And if you call right now, KBOO gets $240 per year.
Oh, wow. That's right. That's incredible. KBOO.FM, 877-500-KBOO. And we'd love to hear the phone ring while we're talking right now, because honestly, we're here because it means a lot to us. I mean, there's a small, completely dedicated staff who runs this radio station, and there is a huge army of volunteers that help run this radio station, but none of it happens without you and your support. None of the conversations you hear, none of the authentic, original, unique voices you hear on KBOO get to be heard without your help. It's the only way we keep the lights on. It's the only way we keep things going, is by you giving during the spring pledge drive. You know, we don't want to interrupt your programming, but I tell you, it's important that we do, to let you know that if you want to continue to hear what you're hearing, then you need to call us. 877-500-KBOO or KBOO.FM.
There's a person in a hat in the back who will collect questions, and then I will try to answer them as I can.
You're listening to Dr. Vysotsky.
How would you respond to people such as Daryl Davis, who advocate for attempting to change fascist minds rather than engaging in militant action? I will say, and I think it's fairly safe to say, that no anti-fascist has a problem with trying to change fascist minds. What anti-fascists, however, are focused on is the mobilization aspect. Because the mobilization aspect is, as I pointed out, the threat aspect. What fascists believe becomes a second-order issue for anti-fascists. Part of anti-fascist activity, there's always been an element of working at some sort of like counter-recruitment, ability to get people out. That, in and of itself, is second order to just making sure that fascists aren't mobilizing, that fascists aren't engaging in the kinds of activities that are building their movement strategically. Changing people's minds is a process that is involved in individual action. It is a process that is timely and time-consuming. And it is a process that people are taking on, and there is a space for that. But that process needs to be thought of as somewhat separate from the process of mobilization. As a collective, right? If we think about fascists as a collective, they are not going to demobilize if we pick off one here and one there and one here and one there, because we get them to become people who are no longer fascist, people who no longer think in these hierarchical ways. The movement is still recruiting. The movement is still doing that work. So you have to get that demobilization to happen. And then once that demobilization has happened, it creates a space that is safe, and that creates the space where you can then start having those discourses about what do people believe, and start working on that step. But you have to be able to ensure that those movements aren't mobilizing, that those movements aren't building. How do people who are more visibly a part of communities that fascists hate, target, engage in anti-fascism without putting themselves in further danger? And specifically, you point out people of color, people who are genderqueer, etc. It is really hard. It is something that is complicated. But the thing to understand about anti-fascist activism is that, as Mark Bray likes to point out, 90% of anti-fascism is stuff that won't put you at risk. I mean, really, 90% of what anti-fascists do is things that would not put a person at risk. They are things that can be done by people from the safety of their home. If you're talking about, like, the intelligence gathering, a lot of it's online now. A lot of it doesn't require the old school having to sit in a car in front of, well, not in front of, but near a fascist house or something to that effect. So intelligence gathering, that can be done in a way that's safe. Educational campaigns. Somebody has to write the literature. Somebody has to lay out the literature. Somebody has to print the literature. Somebody can even put out the literature in ways that don't put them in risk. There are so many things that people can do to be anti-fascist that don't necessarily involve them having to take level of risk. Every anti-fascist has to go through a process of what level of risk am I willing to take? And everybody has different levels of risk. If you want to get involved in formal anti-fascism, you can approach people and find a way that you can contribute. How do you respond to the suggestion that we should just ignore them? They really do want attention. They want the cameras. They want the spotlighting. Because there's a reward there, right? To some extent, strategically, it would almost make sense to ignore them. Imagine if the fascists had a rally and all they did was stand around and yell at each other. The problem is that they have the rally, and it does seem silly. And then, yeah, for a few people, it might not seem fun. But for most of them, after that rally, they're going to be like, woohoo, we had such a great rally. And then they're going to produce media material. In one of my courses, I was talking about fascist recruitment tactics and showing them YouTube videos. Patriot Front has all of these videos of like 15 of them standing somewhere being like, woohoo, we had this rally in the middle of the night that nobody could oppose. That works. Because they go, look, we're doing something. If we ignore them, it's not like they're actually going to go away. They're not Tinkerbell. They're not weird little fascist fairies that if we don't believe in them, their fascism just disappears. They continue to organize. They continue to build their movement. You know, if they have rallies that no one opposes, then what that tells them is that no one opposes them. And so they'll keep going. They'll have another rally. And that rally will maybe have more people. And yeah, maybe they have to bust them in from out of town, but there'll be a bigger rally. And they will just keep doing it. So ignoring them doesn't make them go away, unfortunately. I wish it did.
That was Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era by Dr. Vysotsky. The speech was recorded by Portland Antifa and edited by Aaron Yankee. Thanks for listening, and thank you for being a member and supporting this kind of important information getting out in the world through KABU.
This is KBOO Portland, coming up at 3 o'clock, which is next. It's a special News and Public Affairs Day airing of Alternative Radio featuring a talk about talk by Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. At 4 p.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. And at 5, it's your KBOO Evening News. All of this programming is made possible by your support. We're in the early stages of our spring membership drive, and we'd urge you to pick up the phone, take a moment, give a call to one of our helpful and friendly volunteers, and make that commitment to join KBOO as a member. Call 877-500-5266, and please do it now.
KBU would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Gravy, with locations in Boise at 3957 North Mississippi Avenue and in Kearns at 3101 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Serving traditional American breakfast and brunch, both locations are open daily from 7:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lunch was provided by Atlas Pizza, located at 3570 Southeast Division Street, open 11:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. or later every day. More information at atlaspizzapdx.com. Dinner was provided by Di Nicola's, located in the Creston Kenilworth neighborhood at 3520 Southeast Powell Boulevard. Di Nicola's authentic Italian restaurant has been a family-run Portland institution for over 40 years, serving classic Italian cuisine and pizza, open daily from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of another PDX Music Video Festival and concert on Saturday, April 13th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Another PDX Music Video Festival and concert is an all-ages event featuring 90 minutes of music videos from 26 Portland music artists. There will also be live performances by Skulldive, Camp Crush, and Sam Dinsmore. Again, that's another PDX Music Video Festival and concert on Saturday, April 13th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KB.